Natural Living with Gary Null, exploring the nature and politics of medicine, health, nutrition, and the environment. And now your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Today, a continuation of our in-depth investigative reporting series on the abuses in psychiatry. Specifically today, we're going to examine electroconvulsive therapy. There is a lot of debate about whether it is safe and effective, humane, necessary. And more often than not, the debate centers upon the different scientific studies. I will deal with that on my next program in depth. But what about the persons who've actually undergone it? Do they count? Should their voice be heard? Time and again, when bureaucrats are getting together to decide that a particular type of behavior is now classified as a psychiatric illness, deserving of a therapy, or that persons who are going through difficult times in their life are now dealing with a brain abnormality, depression, to which electroconvulsive therapy is the remedy. Do they ever actually take the time, 6 months or a year later or 2 years later, to sit down with the person and say, "How are you feeling? What's different? Did this help you? Are you worse?" That doesn't happen. And even if it did, we can't assume that there would be any kind of constructive feedback that would lead to any change in this procedure. Today you're going to hear from the persons who have undergone electroconvulsive therapy, so you can see from their point of view what it's meant to them. And time permitting, I will have as many as 10 different people giving their input, and on other upcoming shows, even more. Let's see who we have on the line now, and hopefully we'll be able to say hello to Lenore. Are you on this line?
Yes.
Thank you very much for being with us today.
Lenore, you're welcome.
You're a vocalist-songwriter.
Mm-hmm.
You play a 12-string guitar.
Yep.
And you're a performer out in Minneapolis.
Right.
And now you live in Los Angeles.
No, I lived in Los Angeles for 10 years, and now I'm in Minneapolis.
Okay. Tell us about your whole experience with electroconvulsive therapy, why you were given it, who was responsible for it, who was behind it, and what the manifestations were.
Well, I wish I knew why they did that to me. I don't know who did it, don't know why. Don't know very much about it, because it kind of wipes you out, you know. I mean, there's just this big, they take, what it does is it replaces all your childhood memories with this horrible memory of just waking up not knowing who you are. So I don't know what kind of a person I would be if they hadn't done that to me, and I know who did it. Iowa City State Mental Institution did it. I don't know why they did it. They were doing it to everyone. I mean, that's where my life began, really. If my memories go back, I remember they were shocking everyone on the ward, young, really old, everyone.
And what were they shocking them for?
I don't know. Ward control? Keep everybody nice and passive?
Mm-hmm. All right. And with that, tell us about what you experienced after the shock therapy.
Well, I was released into someone's custody. I didn't even know who it was. It was a man who was coming into the institution and actually raping me, and I didn't even know who it was. It turned out to be someone I had been dating before I was incarcerated there. And I didn't know who this person was, and he was having sex with me in the institution. And then I was released to his custody because I was indigent. I had no family. And so we went back to his parents' house. Now, I had just turned 18. They waited till I turned 18 before they shocked me. And I didn't recognize the house. I didn't know who he was. And when I ran into people that I knew, had known for years, I didn't know who they were. So I kind of had to grow a new soul.
continue on.
Well, it took me like 7 years to get away from this guy. He was really, really a horrible person. I don't know, I don't know what kind of person I would be if I hadn't had that done. But I pulled myself together. I write songs. A lot of them are about my experiences and about shock. I'm very against shock. I think it should be banned. It's barbaric. I think that people who say that it saved their lives have recovered from it in spite of what it's done to them and not because of what it's done. I think that there are other alternatives to depression, and I don't believe that depression has to be a brain abnormality. You know, I think that there are lots of reasons for it. Some of them are cultural, and some of them are personal. It's rage, it's sadness. I mean, if they come up to someone who's depressed and said, how would you like to go out to a farm and ride some horses and take care of these animals for a while, then maybe that'll make you feel better. And then someone said, that really helped me. But all they offer is, well, you're really depressed. Why don't we shock you? And you see, there are different things that you can offer to people who are depressed, and that shouldn't be one of them. You know, it's a horrible experience to have no memory of who you are and wonder when you see people talking, what could they possibly be talking about? Because you don't have anything in your head.
What I'd like to do is have you explain to us the difference in a day in your life after you were shocked and a difference today. And also, I'm sure you've met many people who have also gone through shock therapy, and try to reconcile in our minds the difference between how the orthodox point of view, that this is good for you, it's going to help you overcome your depression or your suicidal tendencies, how that really balances with what you're actually feeling afterwards. Do you still feel depressed, or do you re-depress, or do you completely forget certain parts of your life? And what happened to those parts you forgot? What if some of that were in learning and skills, or even word association, or people? Tell us about that as well.
Got a hold of you and shocked you. You would have to learn that all over again, and it would be more difficult. It erases everything. I don't know. You know, I didn't know what depression was until they shocked me. I had no idea how depression, what it even was. I mean, they introduced me to depression, is what they did. And so, I can't tell you what the difference now between a day in my life is that I'm a functioning normal person, except for I have a lot of rage toward the industry of psychiatry. It shouldn't be an industry. I didn't even know what depression was until they introduced it to me through shock treatment. I didn't have any depression. So I'm not the normal case where I go in and say, I'm suicidal, help me. And then they say, well, maybe shock will help. So it really isn't like that for me. They were taking everybody and shocking them. I don't remember anyone telling me what was going on or anything. All they said was, there's some treatments. We're going to give you some treatments. Then I found out what true depression was.
Tell us what that journey back entailed. What did you have to redo?
I had to learn how to read and write, talk and think.
All over again.
Yes. I couldn't write. I mean, my hands shook so terribly. I couldn't talk because I didn't have anything to say because there was nothing in my head. I would just look at these homes as they would like take us bowling and stuff. So we'd be on the bus and I would be looking at these homes rolling by and just wishing with all my heart that one of those homes was mine and that I wasn't sitting in this bus. Every single home I saw, I wished that was my house. You know, it was really, really horrible.
Did you have any memory of your home where you had grown up?
No.
None? Any memory of your parents?
No, no memory of anything. I didn't even know what my name was. They completely wiped me out.
And so at age 18,
right,
they completely eliminated 17 years of your entire life.
Yeah, they did, yeah. And it took a long, long time for it to come back, and it would come back. And eventually, I think that, you know, if you're not surgically lobotomized, your memories will come back, because memories aren't stored in the brain, you know. They're stored in your mind. They're stored in a place other than your brain. From Akashic records that people talk about, people know that memories are not stored in the brain. So they can come back. They didn't all come back, because right before the shock, I don't remember a lot of events leading up to it, and I don't remember the experience. So, but my life came back to me in kind of snapshots. Like I've got a card deck of 52 cards, and there's 52 memories, and there's like snapshots. There's no connective between the memories, like what you did, you know, like coming home from school or anything like that. But there's certain memories, like snapshots of houses that we lived in and things that happened. And I got a pretty good sense of who I was, just because I was determined, you know, to pull myself back together again, and I had to have some kind of something to go on. So the memories can come back. You can fix yourself. You can regrow all that stuff and learn to talk again. And
how many years did that take?
All my life, ever since they did it.
How old are you now?
46.
46. So 18 years of your life erased. And then you've taken all the rest of your life up to this point to redevelop. And they did it all in the name of helping you.
Oh, I don't know about that. I think that they'd had their own reasons, you know.
Yep.
They were experimenting on people. They still do it. It hasn't changed much. Now they give you drugs that are just as devastating as shock. Drugs that are just horrible, that wipe out your memory, that bring you down, really, really down low.
Which drugs?
Pardon me?
Which drugs are you referring to?
Oh, the neuroleptics that they give you, the antipsychotics that they give people. Now, well, they're giving everybody antidepressants now. I mean, if you go in and say, I want to quit smoking, they give you an antidepressant. You know, these are all drugs that mess with the brain firing, the connective neurons between the brain, and they're finding out that they can kind of mess with that. They can make designer people. If you go in and say, I'm depressed, they can give you a drug that makes you real social now. And so everybody can be real happy. But they don't really, they never did ask me what was wrong, or, you know, what was wrong with me, or, you know, or anything like that. All they want to do is just make designer people now. I'm really against the whole industry. I know people write to me now, because I perform here, and I know a lot of people, and I have some stuff up on the internet, and I do gossip columns and stuff. So people write to me about, well, should I take antidepressants? And I say, no, take ginkgo tea and take ginseng tea. These are gentle things that will speak to you. And they're afraid to take them. They think that, oh, it's just an herb, it won't help. So they go and they take the antidepressant pill, because it's an easy way. Then they don't have to make tea and mess around. People have to take their health into their own hands, not expect someone to give them a pill to fix stuff. It doesn't fix things.
Alrighty.
Well, I appreciate you coming on, Lenore, and sharing these insights. Thank you very much. Let's go over and say hello to our next panelist, and he is Don. Hi, Don.
Hi, Gary.
Don, tell us about how you ended up getting electroconvulsive therapy.
Well, actually, it was insulin shock, Gary.
Okay.
Which is in some ways more horrible than electroshock, but it's still a convulsive therapy.
Explain
it
that
was.
To us.
Well, insulin, as you know, is the only given as a treatment for diabetes, but in psychiatry it was the treatment of choice for people labeled schizophrenic for 25 years. Started in Europe and it came here to North America, and I was labeled schizophrenic, and I went into one coma, had 50 subcoma shocks, which you know, it just terrorized the hell out of me. And what you do is, well, what happens with insulin shock is you become so so debilitated, and you sweat like a pig after 20 minutes, and then you eventually start to convulse. And if they don't stop the reaction with fruit juice laced with sugar, then you go into a coma, which happened once. But they never explained or fully informed me about the terrible effects before they shot me up with insulin shock, which is the same thing that's going on with electroshock, where people are not informed about the terrible effects, like memory loss and brain damage. Fortunately, I didn't have brain damage, but if I had gone into another coma from insulin shock treatment, I probably would have. But that was back in the 50s. But they stopped doing insulin shock because there were too many deaths. That was in terrible reactions. They stopped it in the mid-60s, but electroshock, of course, is steadily increasing, unfortunately, as a, you know... And I call it cruel. I call it a barbaric treatment that is electroshock, and it's, you know, it's got to stop. It's causing an epidemic of brain damage around the world.
Don, do you have friends or others that you've communicated with who've also had shock treatments?
Oh, yes, many. I've probably talked with roughly 200 people in the last, well, easily that in the last 20 years since I've been speaking out against shock here in Toronto and elsewhere and in the States.
Have
with
there been?
Friends, Leonard Roy Frank, whom you know, has inspired me to keep going. Wendy Funk here in British Columbia had a lot of shock, 40-some shock treatments, which wiped out the first 30 years of her life.
What are some of the common statements of those 200-plus people? You could find certain common threads.
Yeah.
That the mainstream media, in its promotion, heavy endorsement of electric shock, including the New York Times.
Right.
What have they missed?
Well, they've missed telling the truth from the survivor's perspectives, like permanent memory loss. Gary, it is tragic. The New York Times, the Toronto Star, the mainstream corporate-controlled media keep promoting the psychiatric lie, the memory's temporary, it's minor, don't worry, dear, I'm paraphrasing this, that your memory will come back in 2 to 3 months. If you have memory loss, it's only for a few months around the treatment. That is a bald-faced lie put forward by the media, and certainly by the shock promoters. The point is that people who have endured at least 6-7 shock treatments, very often over 10, have permanent memory loss going back. It can be months, but more often than not, it's years. And the memory is spotty. It's not surprising that memory loss is generally permanent. If you put electrodes over the part of the brain, like the temporal lobes where shock is given, the memory is stored. Our memories are generally stored in the temporal lobes. I'm not a neurologist, but I know that from basic biology. And if you put 150 to 200 volts every time you give a treatment, then you're going to have a lot of damage. And the other thing is that brain damage is denied massively by the Canadian Psychiatric Association. They totally deny it. The media do not talk about the tragic brain damage, of which permanent memory loss is an indication. And another thing is, many people I've talked with complain they can't concentrate as well as they used to. They can't learn as well. For example, a friend of mine, Connie Neal, whom I haven't seen in quite some time, she was voted best actress in Canada. She had about 16 or 18 shocks in Hamilton Psychiatric Hospital and here in Ontario, and that ruined her acting career because she found it almost impossible to remember lines in a play. These are common, and the media downplay this, and it's absolutely irresponsible journalism. In fact, I wouldn't even call it journalism. It's just hype that the media just echo, parrot these lies, because it's in the interests of psychiatry to keep people passive and to make a lot of money off people's suffering, and that's what's going on. But you won't find that kind of statement in the New York Times or on the CBC in Toronto, in Canada. I mean, this is a big money grab in the United States, but certainly it's going on a lot in Canada. Particularly, women are being shocked. 70% of the shock is given to women. Of that, 50% are over 60 years old. So we've got sexist and ageist factors operating in this so-called safe and effective procedure. And I just am very pleased that you are giving some of us a real, you know, allowing us a voice to voice our criticism and concerns, because we certainly don't get the voices in mainstream media that we should.
Well, there's going to be more of this, that I can assure you. Don, thank you very much for sharing your insights with us.
Well, thank you, and thank you, Gary, and I respect you an awful lot for doing this.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
And let's go over and say hello to our next panelist, Ted. Hi, Ted.
Hello.
Ted, could you take us on a journey of what happened when you were given electric convulsive therapy, before and after?
I was 6 years old, and I was a foster child, and foster parents don't really have any legal authority over their children. And so at that time at Bellevue Hospital in New York City, there a psychiatrist named Dr. Loretta Bender was conducting experiments on giving shock treatment to children. And since I was available as a foster child, I was given a diagnosis of childhood schizophrenia and taken to Bellevue, where I was given 20 shock treatments. And it was a terrifying experience. I remember they used to take us onto the other ward, and we were supposed to sing, and I remember this song, this little children's song, it still freaks me out, you know, row, row, row your boat and all that stuff. And I knew that when I wasn't being given breakfast, I was going to have a shock treatment, so I was very unhappy. Instead of singing, I cried, so they wrote that down as a sign of my sickness. And when I got back home, I had been a very shy child before, but I was terrified then. And I had forgotten a lot of things. I used to ride my tricycle all around my neighborhood, and I knew all the streets in my neighborhood. And I remember taking my tricycle confidently to some street or other and all of a sudden realizing I didn't know where I was, and I just started crying. There was a little boy who was, they said he'd been my best friend. He lived two houses away, and I didn't remember who he was when I got back. So they said that was a symptom of my schizophrenia, although we all know that shock treatment, you know, causes the memory loss. So after 5 months, I knew when September came. I passed my seventh birthday, and when I was 7 and a half in October of 1944, they sent me to Rockland State Hospital, which is about 20 miles from New York City, and I spent the next 10 years there, and I got out when I was 17. And it's hard to say what I lost, you know, but because when you're an adult, you have a lot of memories, and you don't really remember too much before the age of 4 anyway as a child. But I don't know, it was as much the shock treatment or the 10 years in Rockland State Hospital, but I wasn't very equipped to go out into the outside world. But eventually I struggled to get an education, and at this point in time, I'm an attorney, and I work for a patients' rights organization here in California. But it was a terrifying experience. Nobody should have to undergo that.
Well, that's what we're doing. We're trying to bring your message and other people's message, because your voices have not been heard. Americans do not know the kind of suffering you have gone through. And if they read the New York Times, and I keep referring to it because it's one of the biggest supporters of electroconvulsive therapy, but there's no Time magazine also. The Quackbusters line up, and along with the National Institutes of Health, virtually all of orthodox psychiatry, with only a handful of exceptions, endorse it. And so everywhere you look, everyone has accepted that it is a legitimate healing tool, a corrective tool, and they don't want to hear the patients, unless there's some poster boy that will get up and say, oh, I was depressed and suicidal and I got it and it saved my life and I'm so much better. Possibly it helped them. But who is talking for the people who were damaged? And like yourself, who had to struggle back. You didn't have schizophrenia.
No, I didn't. Obviously, I didn't. I think that everything in my, you know, the psychiatrist had control of me my entire childhood. And if I was going to be crazy, I'd certainly be crazy by now. But I think the reason you see this is that psychiatrists are looked at as like godlike figures by people, whereas somebody who has a psychiatric history is completely looked down on. You know, you have, at the time we had the vote to ban shock treatment in Berkeley, California, the National Institute of Mental Health said that at that time there were 7 million people in this country who had shock treatment. But, you know, nobody wants to talk about it. You may remember that Thomas Eagleton, the senator from Missouri, who was a vice presidential candidate in, I'm not sure which year that was, 72, when it was discovered that he had shock treatment, he was just removed from the Democratic ticket. It's just completely discrediting. But I think people should start listening to folks that have had this kind of experience, because it could happen to them. I mean, I know a number of people who thought psychiatry was just wonderful, and they signed themselves in, and they discover that it certainly wasn't that wonderful after all. It could happen to anyone. The grounds, right now there's a big campaign to make the grounds for locking people up easier and easier, and folks think that they're immune to this and it can't happen to them, and these experiences only happen to these weirdos sitting in a corner talking to themselves. But the fact of the matter is the President's Commission, the Surgeon General's mental health report last year claimed that over half the people in the country would be mentally ill at some time in their lives, and that at any given time about 22% of people in this country are mentally ill. Now, I don't know if I really believe that figure, but that's the official psychiatric line. So how about that? I think people that are listening to your program, if they're listening to it with someone else, they should each look at each other and decide which one of them is part of the 50% that's going to be mentally ill. I mean, it's very scary. People should realize this. It's very easy to get locked up, and once you're locked up, they can do all sorts of things to you. People should realize it's going to affect them. It's not just a small group of weird people. I was just a shy kid. That's all that was wrong with me. What I really needed was to have been sent to a school for gifted children. My life would have been much differently, but because they were looking for experimental subjects.
Well, you know, Ted, they've now made shyness a psychiatric disorder.
Yes, I know. They've made almost everything a psychiatric disorder.
I received a call from a hospital, from someone in this audience, and who was going to be told they had to have electroconvulsive therapy, this week. And the reason was, and we tracked it down, is because this person who separated from their husband, the husband was having arguments with her over her having a right to change the locks on her home. So she didn't want the husband having access whenever he wanted to the home, so she changed the locks. Mm-hmm. He came and took the locks out. Mm-hmm. She called the police to come out to see this. They saw this. The husband then made a statement that the wife was crazy. They then took her down to the hospital for observation. A psychiatrist met with the husband and her, then diagnosed her as being delusionally psychotic, and to be remanded to the hospital because she didn't appreciate the suggestions of the husband. And she had to call, and we had to intercede. And I interceded this week and got our attorneys and everyone else in my office working on this. This is just an everyday thing, and yet that is what happens. Someone can be institutionalized and shocked or given medications that easily.
That's right, and I think that this kind of marital disputes are a very common kind of road for people to wind up in that situation. You have somebody motivated to discredit the other spouse, and it's all too easy for people to be locked up. They don't have to have any psychiatric histories. They don't have to be weird and strange. They just have to have, because you know, a lot of these private hospitals, too, they want to fill their beds, and they'll do anything to keep their beds filled. People should realize that this is a risk to everyone, because everyone can become emotionally upset. Everybody, you know, I think that 50% figure, what I think is actually real, is that 50% of the population at some time in their lives will be so emotionally distraught that it's going to seriously affect, you know, their life functioning. And that's, you know, that happens, you know. Something happens in your life, a divorce, death in your family, and you're really upset, and you're somewhat non-functional for a while. And at that point, you're very vulnerable to being locked up. And I'll tell you, my understanding of the, you know, the laws or the way they're enforced in New York, you're a lot more vulnerable than you are out here, where I'm directing attorney of an organization where we provide hearings to people. So it's possible to get people out of the institution here. The laws are better enforced. But even then, it's still too easy to get locked up. But certainly in a place like New York, where you'd have to have the wherewithal to get a lawyer if you're locked up, once you're in there, you can't get out.
Well, you're right, but we're working on that. I have a demonstration in just 2 days on this. And I'm testifying this afternoon. In fact, I'm rushing out of the studio in just about a half hour to go to give testimony before a legislative hearing on this.
I've heard about that, and I think it's wonderful that Assemblyman Luster is having this hearing, and I think it's wonderful that you're supporting something like this. And I hope as many people as possible show up to that demonstration, because everyone's in danger from this. The profession of psychiatry is out of control, and people need to look at it and see what's really happening.
We just think of how many children we've lost. 7 million children are now taking psychoactive drugs.
I know.
And we've lost those children because they've been stigmatized, possibly for life, because we trusted the school teachers. Big mistake. We trust psychiatrists. Never do that. And I don't believe in mental illness. So I'm taking a completely different approach. And by the way, as a scientist and as an educator, I would like for you to show me the papers that legitimize the uniqueness or originality of a brain function in a schizophrenic.
That's right. Although they babble about, you know, chemical imbalances and stuff like that. There's no solid research that shows anything like that.
None.
And plus, you know, this thing about giving people drugs for depression, and the psychiatrists say there's an epidemic of depression. Well, if there's an epidemic, where does it come from? I think it comes from because our society is making people very unhappy, and the solution is not to give drugs to massive numbers of people. The solution is to look at our society and see why are people unhappy.
Well, look at Seraphim.
Oh, yes, right. That's the latest. It's a repackaging of Prozac to suit the latest psychiatric diagnosis,
making
premenstrual
every woman
unhappiness.
Yeah, every woman who ever had any blues or mood swings due to their period will now think this is the ticket. No, it's not.
But it's a chemical lobotomy. And they now have a psychiatric label to follow them around. And I think most women will have some distress at some time with their menstrual cycle.
Well, everybody has distress. We all go through crisis.
Absolutely.
It doesn't mean that what we feel when we're in a crisis is a disease to which we are necessitated to have a pathological intervention.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. And again, I say that if people are unhappy, if there's a lot more people unhappy, the solution is not to say there's an epidemic of depression. The solution is to say something is wrong in our society that makes people so unhappy, and we ought to be looking at that and not giving people drugs. And it's very ironic. You know, you have a government claiming to have a war on drugs, and at the same time, the same government is doing everything they can to force people to take drugs. The only difference is the street drugs. Drug corporations don't make money off them. And, and that's really what's motivating all this. There's big profits to be made if you have everybody on psychiatric drugs, big profits to some corporations, but a terrible loss for our society. People just have to look at this. I was just a shy kid. There was nothing really wrong with me. And I spent most of my childhood in a hospital because I had, you know, foster parents who couldn't stop it. And this happens a lot. In fact, it's very common now that the most common thing now with foster children is they're frequently just put on these heavy-duty antipsychotic drugs that they just act up and act upset. Well, hey, you know, if you've never had a stable family and you're 10 years old, of course you're going to be upset. And the solution to that, obviously, is the kid needs attention and love and respect, and instead you just put these kids on psychiatric drugs that leave them with conditions like tardive dyskinesia, you know, when they're not even 12 years old. I mean, I've seen things like that. We go into facilities here with, you know, these kids are such appealing kids, you know, to me, and there they are loaded up with drugs. Sometimes they can barely walk. And what have they done? You know, they've just been, they run away from their foster home or something like that. Well, okay, that's a problem, you know, but you don't solve it with drugs. You solve it with care. You know, you solve it with paying attention to the needs of this child. And it's just, actually, I have a very hard time going into these places because it just reminds me of my own childhood. The first time I went into one, I cried. The advocate who was training me just, you know, I just had to leave the ward, and I stood in the hallway and cried for a while before I could go back on that unit to see all these kids, you know, locked up in a psych ward just like I was. It was just too much for me to handle.
You know, when you're a kid and you always think that good things can happen, because with children we have innocence and honesty in our dreams and aspirations. But when you're locked up in a ward and you have no one to create that bonding love and attention and kindness, and no one to share your holidays and birthdays and special times, then one day you don't know if you're ever going to get out.
That's right. And the thing is, you know, the thing about being institutionalized and being in these psych wards is that everybody around you, all the adults with power over you, are basically telling you, you're not worth anything. You're subhuman. And what kind of an adult are you going to be if you grow up with that? I can tell you, I had a struggle with that for decades. I have a fairly good life now, but it took me 35 or 40 years to get to this point in my life, because I had to overcome all that terrible messages I was getting when I was a child. The only thing I can say that I was lucky about is that at that time they didn't have the psychiatric drugs. I got out just before they started giving Thorazine to everybody everywhere. And if I'd have spent my childhood, you know, on drugs, I wouldn't be talking to you on the radio now. I'd be sitting and drooling in front of a TV and some board and care, if I were alive at all, because I'm 64 now, and it's a lifetime of psychiatric drugs. There's been a study in Massachusetts that showed people on heavy-duty psychiatric drugs for long periods of time have a lifespan about 15 years shorter than the average population. And of course they do, because these drugs are very destructive. They cause all kinds of problems, diabetes. You know, you bloat up and get hugely overweight, eye problems, huge amounts of problems. But again, because it happens to people who have this psychiatric label, nobody cares. But again, I say, don't think you're immune from a psychiatric label. And as you pointed out, Mr. Noll, this new diagnosis, I think it's called premenstrual dysphoria, where you're supposed to take this repackaged Prozac for it. This means every woman there is could have that label. Every woman, you know, of that age would be considered mentally ill now with that label. And, you know, once you have any kind of a psychiatric label, you're in big trouble.
Ted, I want to thank you very much for sharing your insights with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you for doing this program, and God bless you. And I hope that demonstrator, I hope everybody listening to your program comes to that demonstration.
Well, we'll have a few.
I think you will.
Take care.
Thank you. Bye.
And let's say hello to Linda. Hi, Linda.
Hi, good morning.
Linda, could you tell us about why you were given electric convulsive therapy and who was responsible, what excuse they were using?
When I was 17 years old, I had taken a month's supply of diet pills that were prescribed, or amphetamines, and hadn't slept for 6 nights. And according to my medical records on admission, that the doctor decided I had acute schizophrenia and the treatment would be electroconvulsive therapy. And my parents were told that unless they signed for the treatments, I would never get well again.
Acute schizophrenia.
Yes.
And how many therapies did they give you?
I had
treatments.
I think I just read something that Roy Frank wrote, and it's probably more accurate to call it electroconvulsive torture, because it was given to me against my will, and I had 15 of these so-called treatments administered to me in a 5-week period.
And what did it do?
It caused the most traumatic experience of my life. This was 37 years ago, and I had memory loss, cognitive difficulties. It felt like I was mentally retarded, or how I imagined somebody would be after having a stroke. I had severe loss of functioning. intellectually and yeah, much impairment.
What were you? What did you have erased in the way of memory?
A lot of things that had happened. I would look at pictures, for example, vacations from many years before and not remember it. I saw myself in the picture, but I wouldn't remember the vacations. I would go to a movie and know that I had seen it before, but not really remember, and this maybe had something I'd seen 6 months before. So whereas people will be told before they have shock treatment, oh, it's just for a few weeks before and after the treatment, that wasn't my experience at all. I had to learn. My abstract thinking was severely affected, especially initially. It's like having to learn to things all over again that I once knew.
So how many people have you spoken with approximately who've had electroconvulsive torture?
I would guess 50 or 60 over the years.
Have their experiences been somewhat similar?
Yes, many of them have. I'm a clinical social worker and have worked at a community mental health center. Some of these people have been my clients. And, you know, have had horrible experiences, as well as people who are really working to see this procedure end. You know, in my opinion, it ought to be banned and, you know, really be looked at under United Nations policies against torture.
Do you believe that before any psychiatrist administers or that he or she should first undergo about 40 sessions themselves?
I really think one would do it for most people. They would never, I mean, it certainly was true for me. After the first one, I knew that someday I had to do something different to help people because my experience was that of torture. I was amazed I was still alive. Although it's, in all honesty, it's not something I would wish on any human being.
Well, there's a judge in New York State that I would wish it on, because of his role in wanting to see that a particular individual who is at Pilgrim State Hospital, at one of the America psychiatric gulag, rivaling that of anything you would have found in Soviet Russia in their mental institutions. It's a horror pit. It should be closed down. The people there should be sued and brought up on war crime violations, but human rights violations. But they won't be. They'll be rewarded and paid. The judge will be, he's a political hack, one of the backroom boys. That's the way it works. You know that. And the only way it's going to stop is if enough people come forward and tell their stories, and suddenly the public says, I didn't know. And then you have to ask two questions. Did you really care? Did you want to know? Well, now that you know, what are you going to do about it? Do nothing or do something? And if you want to do something, then let people who are in positions who do at least have some compassion left in their spirit, let them enact laws that ban it.
I think you'll find there are judges in the United States, unfortunately, that would act much similarly to this particular judge you're speaking of in New York. It's just kind of oftentimes a rubber stamp procedure once a psychiatrist recommends involuntary electroshock.
That's why I believe that every judge who's going to sit on a case should first try it to see what they are allowing someone to go through, because they're told it's safe, humane, and effective.
Yeah, sometimes experientially, having that, you have a point, would be may make some difference.
Well, I appreciate the work you're doing, Linda, and thank you very much for being on.
Thank you.
That's Linda. We've gone further in the show than what we normally do before we take a little station ID break, but we're going to do that now, and we'll return. I'm Gary Nall, continuation of our ongoing in-depth investigative report on the abuses in psychiatry, an examination of electroconvulsive to some therapy, to others, torture. And we're back, and I will be continuing with our interviews, not today, because in just a few minutes I have to scoot out of the studio. I have to go and make a formal presentation before a legislative body and hearings. I prepared should be disseminated to as many people who care about this as possible, because it gives the science knowing that these people are going to have the lobbyists, the special interest groups behind the scenes coaching them and trying to tell them that these are just a bunch of, oh, people who are deranged. Well, we want to show that there are those of us who are going to be testifying today who are not deranged and who come with more science and more scientific background in these areas than the psychiatrist. And we will not have opinions. We'll be sharing just hard evidence, objective, and let them then see the truth. What they do with it then is up to their own individual determinations. So, fellas, I'm not going to be able to hang around very much longer today because I've got a specific time I'm supposed to be there, and I want to get to the hearings. It takes a while to get there. But I will be back on Monday. I'm actually going to be doing the demonstration.
Mm-hmm. And we'll have recording on Monday. We'll have a show on Monday.
And I will be doing on Tuesday my report. The report will be the definitive report, white paper, investigative report on electroconvulsive therapy. I will be putting it up on the web page next week with all the scientific references, and there are many scientific references, which is kind of interesting when you think about when a reporter does a story, shamelessly promoting it, interviewing a few people over at one of the local hospitals about how they have found it help people prevent suicide and help people with depression when nothing else would work. And then they say, well, there's been some controversy. And then they skip over it like, but it's not real. And I go out there and I find all these studies from their journals that clearly, overwhelmingly, would have kept anyone from suggesting this is a legitimate or safe or effective or humane therapy, then how can they call themselves journalists? How can they even think that this is something that should be offered to the public? And yet it's shamelessly done all the time. So hopefully some people in this audience will join me this Monday at noon in front of the Attorney General's Spitzer's office at 120 Broadway, where in a peaceful, completely nonviolent, but very important a protest will be there to demonstrate our concern for the rights of everyone not to have electroconvulsive therapy and to offer legislation, which we've already prepared and already have put it into the hands of legislators. And if the people speak out about it, I'm sure it will make a difference. And the first step in that effort is to see if we can get some people out. And because think of all the kids who are right now sitting on a ward, tranquilized, because it's profitable. Giving shock therapy lined up, like this Ted just said, lined up and going to go through all that trauma and pain and have nothing when they come out in their memory. And the psychiatrists, the social workers, the psychologists, the nurses, the physicians, the anesthesiologists, the hospital administrators, the board of the hospital, everyone is complicit in that crime against humanity, against that little kid. And yet they'll go home to their children. And do you think for a second that they would advise that for their children? No way. But for other children? Sure. Why not? Let's just live in Scarsdale. So think about that. Think about the nature, the ethic of people who even work at Pilgrim State Hospital. I'd like to see that place closed. Now, that won't happen. But at least we can let people know we are concerned about this barbaric therapy. This is no different than bloodletting was, but this is far worse in some respects. And some of the other stupid therapies, like water dipping, where they used to tie a person into a chair and dip them upside down in cold water to cure their insanity. Well, this is one therapy that we should deal with now. So that's what I'm going to be doing today. I'm going out to do my part in making a formal presentation and take their challenges. And I hope they got some really smart psychiatrists sitting behind them so that they can ask tough questions. Because I like it when you go up against the best. And that's what I'm prepared for. I will not go, trust me, when I'm fighting on the public's behalf, I will not go down easily. They will find a hard question that I won't be able to answer specifically and passionately and directly. So that's where I'm going, and I will see you all on Monday, and you all have a good day, and hopefully on Sunday night you can listen to my programs too on WNEW 102.7 FM from 8 to 9. That's WNEW 102.7 FM on 8 to 9. Then at 9 o'clock, WEVD 1050 AM on the dial. So, fellas, you have a good day. Did you reach your 10,000 yesterday?
Yes, in fact, we did break that.
We did break it
in the final minute. We made it just across the line.
Okay, well, today you might also want to consider, I think we still have in the package, the seven steps.
I don't think we've registered that one yet.
Oh, we didn't?
We're going to stay with the two. We're going to stay with the joy and the boomers.
Well, I'll tell you, with the boomers, go to the section in here on about parenting and how much of our rights as parents have we given away to the so-called authorities. Because most of those kids getting Luvox and Ritalin and Prozac, those are baby boomers' kids.
Mm-hmm.
And ask why. How can people who are so educated and supposedly so conscious, how could they make those mistakes? Well, I answer those questions in that one section there because, again, it's mistakes we make. And the whole book is about at some point in our life we have to stop and look at what we've done and learn from our mistakes so we can not make them again and make proper choices in the future. So hopefully that book will be the inspiration for a lot of people to turn their life around and to start to do things in a more constructive and healthy and positive way. And it's a feel-good, do-good, can-do kind of book. It's called The Baby Boomer's Guide to Getting It Right Second Time Around. And it really goes well with The Joy of Juicing, which has been very popular. So I'll let you all go because I've got to get myself